From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Agusia. Neil deGrasse Tyson says your favorite sci-fi movie is definitely fiction.
Why is it that Sandra Bullock, a medical doctor, is repairing the Hubble Space Telescope? Excuse me, we don't send medical doctors to repair the Hubble Space Telescope any more than we're going to send a mechanical engineer to do open heart surgery on you.
Ahead this hour, we hear from Tyson about the importance of science education, real science education. But first, we want to hear from you. On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee stepped down last week after almost 4 years in this chair. We're playing some of her best segments this week to celebrate her time with us. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Matt Wiggins, W-I-G-G-I-N-S, from Jonesboro, and I just wanted to call in to let it be known that my favorite Celeste Headlee moment would have to be during the segment of what it means to be Southern, because she pronounced my name incorrectly. And I was one of the only few people who called in whose call-in segment was used, and she said my name, and for like 5 seconds I felt NPR famous, only because Celeste Headlee has got to be one of the most dominant figures in radio for me. I love hearing her, and it's because I don't just hear her, I feel her. She has so much passion for what she does, and although it's sad to hear she is stepping down, I will always remember that one incident.
What's your favorite Celeste conversation that we've aired? Give us a call and leave a message, 404-500-9457. You can post to Facebook or on Twitter. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. And remember that we might feature your comments on the show. The B-52s have been a major part of Georgia's music scene since the 70s, when the band formed in Athens. The group's meteoric rise was fueled by hits like Love Shack. That's Kate Pearson, a founding member of the B-52s. She's one of the most accomplished collaborators in the music business, performing with the likes of Iggy Pop, The Ramones, and R.E.M. Pearson takes the stage tonight at Atlanta Symphony Hall with the B-52s. Celeste Headlee spoke to her a couple of years ago about the release of her first solo album, Guitars and Microphones. Kate began by explaining how she's kept that amazing singing voice after all these years.
Well, I always warm up. I don't drink a lot, you know, I don't really drink myself into oblivion every night.
That helps.
I mean, it helps to keep healthy and stuff, but I credit it mainly to my voice teacher, Janet Frank, who sadly passed away years ago from ALS, but she really helped me, you know, she would say like a baby can scream and scream and not get hoarse. And that's true. I think if you support your voice, and I did a lot of work with her, and not about style, more about preserving and saving my voice.
So I wanted to ask you about another relatively new development in pop music, and that has been sort of the rise of the non-singing performance artist to a certain extent. I want to be as courteous as I can possibly be, and I'm talking about the kind of performer who puts on an incredible show, but if you took it all away, couldn't actually sing well. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, clearly there's a place for that. There's a lot of people that really, really like that. But that's not something that you or your bandmates ever seem to go in for, although clearly the B-52s put on a pretty wild show as well. How do you balance that the big sort of almost Las Vegas style performance versus the inherent quality of the musicianship?
Well, nowadays, people have so much added to their band sound, like tracks going and all kinds of things going that, you know, Fred always calls it live-ish. But we're live, but we have some little percussion things going on maybe on some songs. But our vocals are totally live, and, you know, it's we can sing. And Fred is sometimes sensitive about, you know, he says, I don't sing, but his voice is so unique. We always say, Fred, no one has the Fred voice but Fred. So
That's true.
It adds this great element. And everything has its place, every style, however it can work. You know, there are bands that sing out of tune, but like The Clash, and I love The Clash. They're one of my favorite bands, and there are people that say Bob Dylan can't sing, and that's crazy. So there's a place for everything, you know, but I do think that maybe live singing is kind of a lost art.
Yeah.
You know, we really belt it out, and we mean it when we sing about Hot Lava and Rock Lobster. You know, we sing it like our lives depend on it, and that is something important, to have that live kind of connection with the audience when you're singing too.
Well, then let's get on to talking about the music itself, because it's great. I mean, it's as a debut artist, what a strong debut. The first track on this album is called Throw Down the Roses, and I've read that you said this was kind of an ode to your childhood. Let's take a listen.
I won't take a hit in the mosh pit. I don't ever sit front rows for losers. I won't ever pay to watch your band play. I need hairspray, groupies for doers.
This to me is like just your... I don't think I can say kick butt on public radio, but it's just such an empowering song. Where did this come from?
Throw Down the Roses was more sort of like when the B-52 started, and ongoing kind of this kind of girl power, you know, independence, and sort of the cliche of the girlfriend rocker, the girlfriend of the rocker guy, claiming her own independence as an artist.
Let's talk about Mr. Sister, and I'm less interested in the controversy that arose just based on a phrase, I guess, that it sounds like people may have taken out of context, but I'm more interested in who you thought the song was aimed at and who you were talking to. So let's take a listen.
Hey, Mr. Sister, you got the
Betrayed by the mirror. Who are you talking to here?
Well, it's really about a young boy or a girl who feels dysmorphic, who looks in the mirror, who can't really feel at home in their own skin, and either has a gender dysmorphia or just feels like they're just not loving themselves. And, you know, it's about empowerment and finding a way to love yourself. And it was, you know, my friend Alan, otherwise known as Tangella, who did drag back in the day, and we always used to call each other Mr. Sister. So it was kind of inspired by that kind of young drag queen boy.
Yeah, there's a lot of affection really, in the song.
Because I think it's personal, you know. I was thinking about Alan and just kind of thinking about his problems, and he's just gone through, you know, just an amazing sort of development, and, you know, it was sort of an ode to him. And also just the B-52s stand so much for people who feel like outsiders. I mean, people say that all the time now, you know, it feels like outside is inside now. The outsiders are insiders. But, you know, there are always people who feel on the fringe and feel misunderstood, and there's bullying and all sorts of things happening now, and cyberbullying. And it's so heartening to hear so many people come up to us. Years and years, you know, people say, you helped us through high school. The B-52s helped me get through these hard times. And I felt like I was the only one at school that listened to this crazy band. And so, you know, I wanted to continue that kind of feeling of reaching out to people who felt like they were on the outside.
You know, you're going back to your days in Athens. I think that there's a lot of people, say, outside of Georgia, who would find the sound of the B-52s to be really uncharacteristic, not just of Georgia, but of the South. And I wonder if you think that's fair. I mean, what was music like in Athens when the B-52s were growing, when say, REM began growing later?
Well, when we started, I moved down to Athens, and there was a feed store and a farmer's hardware, and I think two feed stores and a farmer's hardware. And the university was, like, very separate, and there was a folk club called The Last Resort, and there really wasn't any kind of scene happening in Athens. And we just started to amuse ourselves to just, you know, pick up instruments and jam, and we just had nothing else to do, and that's why we called ourselves the Deadbeat Club. I mean, Fred and I were working, we all had some jobs, and Cindy worked at the Whirlicue, and I worked at the Athens Banner Herald as a paste-up artist, and Fred was a waiter at the local vegetarian restaurant, and Keith and Ricky worked at the bus station that Keith's parents managed. So we all had these little jobs, and we just didn't imagine going beyond I guess, the town, really, just playing in town. And certainly we got, we were outsiders when we started, and we didn't know if anyone would like our music. We didn't have much of a goal. So the only place to play was Atlanta, and then we went to New York. So we just blazed a trail from Athens to New York. Finally, the last resort allowed us to play there. And, you know, the first place we played was a house party in Athens, which it, the house nearly fell down around us when we played. And our friends came up to New York and danced and played. And after that, then all these original bands started, like Pylon and Love Tractor and REM. So we kind of like, I think we just started that fire, but it was also in the air, you know, all little towns all over America, this was sort of happening.
But people must have looked at you and said, oh, look, it's possible. It's possible to go from Athens to New York and then elsewhere.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, in Athens, I mean, as far as what was happening in Athens, I think we started the, you know, we lit the tinder there, the tinder box that got people going to New York, because all the bands that followed. And what was great is every band was striving to be unique. Nobody aspired to, let's try to sound like the B-52s. Let's all do our own thing. And every band like that came out of Athens sounded so unique.
Before you go, I just wanted to ask a question pretty much just for myself. And that's kind of, you are one of those artists who's such a great collaborator. I wonder if you think that's a talent that you're born with, or do you have to develop how to be a good collaborator?
You do have to learn to be a good collaborator. You definitely have to take, you know, you have to be in the service of the song, and you have to take some ego out of it. You know, a little ego is good, but, you know, you have to really give and take and kind of think what's best for the song and not like my part. But the B-52 song structures have been varied, and sometimes like the chorus doesn't happen until the end, and that's because we had so much stuff, we had so much gold. It's like that part, we got to get that part and that part in. So we would jam and then pick out the parts almost like in collage fashion, and then Cosmic on through, Keith Strickland did all the instrumentation. So you know, we would jam more or less to what he had written. Sometimes it would surprise him, though, because he'd think, oh, this is the chorus, and it would wind up being the verse. And, you know, he'd have to redo everything. But I think collaboration is something very special. And it's like, geez, it's like sex or something, you know, when you're sharing all this together. It's a family affair. You get into each other's psyche, you know, and you kind of and when you're jamming, you have to kind of make a rule. Don't make fun of someone, you know, and say, oh, that's stupid. Like, cut down the idea. You have to let the ideas float and sort of have their life before you can sort of judge.
That's singer and songwriter Kate Pearson of the B-52s. She spoke with now former On Second Thought host Celeste Headlee back in 2015. Just ahead, Alice Walker on how she brought The Color Purple to life. But first, Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about what it means to be a black astrophysicist from the Bronx. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Our next guest wears many hats. He is an acclaimed astrophysicist.
In our own Milky Way, it's as though we're looking past a screen door through the void of intergalactic space to another galaxy.
You may know him from watching PBS.
Hi, I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson, your host of Nova Science Now, where this season we're asking six big questions. On this episode, where did we come from?
Or you may know him from the popular show Cosmos, a space-time odyssey.
If life has a sanctuary, it's here in the nucleus, which contains our DNA. The ancient scripture of our genetic code. And it's written in a language that all life can read.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has written nearly a dozen books and holds 18 honorary doctorates. He spoke with Celeste Headlee before a talk at Atlanta's Fox Theater back in 2014.
You know, it's not general that a scientist, an acclaimed scientist, let me put it this way, acclaimed scientists aren't always the greatest communicators to the mass public. That's fair, right?
Sure, but that would be true for any field.
Right. Exactly. But I think science is particularly difficult because you're dealing with so many technical terms, you're dealing with so many concepts that many people don't encounter on a regular basis, as opposed to...
There's a mismatch lexicon, you're saying, between what the trade of science is and what the general public normally uses in their daily communication.
Right, which is why, as a journalist, I can say sometimes it's difficult to interview scientists because they speak... They're used to speaking to other scientists,
mm-hmm.
and they can leave people confused.
Yeah, and I would say that there are two things going on here. One is in the scientific field, one is not rewarded professionally for reaching to the public or for writing for the public or for communicating with the public. You're in the trenches to make discoveries in your lab, in your, you know, at the observatory, whatever is your place of investigation. And so part of that culture, I think, needs to change. And it already has changed a bit in my own field, astrophysics, in large measure, I think, because of Carl Sagan, who did it first, and he did it big. And initially, and there's some blood on the tracks there from him having stepped there. But
Wait. Let me help you. Help me understand what you mean when you say blood on the tracks. He did venture into some controversial areas. Is that what you mean?
No. What I mean is he's a scientist, and then he decides to appear on Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show.
Oh, right.
Well, that kind of appearance for a scientist was basically without precedent.
Yeah.
It was okay to show up on a documentary or maybe in a newscast, but on a evening talk show entertainment television and use that as a venue to share science with the public, this did not go without criticism from his colleagues. But what happened over the years was people started noticing where they wanted the funding to increase for the National Science Foundation or for NASA, and they would speak to their representatives, and the representatives said, "Oh, you work in this university, and you're studying a subject that I just learned about in Carl Sagan's Cosmos. Great, let's do more of that." And so it was that kind of exposure that lifted all boats because the tide waters rose by the public's embracing the methods and tools of science and just what it is to engage in cosmic discovery. So my field has already sort of transitioned by my read of things. There are other scientific fields that I don't think have. And so if you are seen out there speaking to the public, it does not accrue to your professional standing. In fact, it could subtract from it.
I wonder what limits there are on that. I mean, it's fantastic for the rest of us when somebody like you is so good at communicating complex topics. And yet there's also been a lot of criticism, say, for somebody like Bill Nye when he decides to debate evolution with a creationist. So are there limits to what's acceptable in this scientific field when it is acceptable?
I don't think anything should ever have limits. If someone, yes, there are those who said Bill Nye should not be giving platform to something that is patently scientifically false. And personally, I don't debate anybody on any subject ever. So I would not have been the one to do that. But Bill was brave, I think, to have gone there and to have brought it out into the public discourse. And we're a free country, so we ought to be able to have that conversation. So I don't have an issue with that. And I don't think there are lines that shouldn't be crossed. As long as as long as the science you convey is has integrity and is accurate and does not mislead or cheapen what is real just for the thrill of bringing it to the public, I think there should be no limits on where that goes. But for example, on the TV series The Big Bang Theory, which is the number one scripted show on television in any genre, that could not have been that successful unless many more than just the geekosphere were watching it. Meanwhile, yes, they be caricatures, no doubt about it, but the science on it has a certain integrity such that it has attracted the appearances of other scientists just as cameo appearances, including that of Stephen Hawking. So if we have scientists appearing, and I even had a cameo on it once.
Yeah.
And so if you have scientists appearing on The Big Bang Theory and enjoying it, and the public enjoys it, and it doesn't subtract from the scientific standing that the person had going in, then there are no limits, because this is a number one sitcom, for goodness sake, not even a news show, not even a fake news show.
I wonder if, is, I mean, it, pardon me for making assumptions, but it feels almost as though your ability to communicate comes naturally to you, or is it something that you had to work at and make a decision in order to pursue?
Well, I take it as a very high compliment that you view it as coming naturally out of me.
You're so very good at it.
It is possible to be really good at something for having tried hard to be good at it.
Very true.
I think of Michael Jordan, who was not a first-round draft pick coming out of college. I don't even think when he entered college that he was on the starting five. So that's someone who continued to work hard at his craft and became the best there ever was in the field. I can tell you that I invest a fair amount of energy thinking about how people think, thinking about what ways mental roadways can become tangled in a person's attempt to understand something. I think about that. Part of it is I'm out in the public. I have a Twitter stream where I can put out a tweet on some fact or phenomenon, and I see immediately, are people getting it? Do they like it? Are they saddened by it? Do they cheer it? Do they retweet it? And so I have ongoing feedback on whether what I'm doing is working or not. And so, yes, that takes some energy from me. It's energy I'm not otherwise putting in the laboratory. And so sometimes I regret that. I mean, I want to spend more time in the lab than I currently do. But to the extent that I'm about to engage the public, I will put it full energy to give the best presentation I possibly can. Or if I'm about to go into an interview, I will look at the rhythms of the interviewer and see where do they typically go? How quickly do they interrupt you? What are the timings relevant to a conversation that person has? So that when I am engaged, I can just be the best I can be in that situation. And I don't know why more people don't do that. They show up on a talk show, and it's like a deer in a headlights when they get asked some questions.
You're preaching to the choir here.
You know, didn't you see what they do in this? Haven't you studied that? And these are people who otherwise invest huge brain energy studying whatever is on the frontier of their profession. So I think it is within reach for more scientists to be completely personable and give excellent interviews in ways that is not currently happening.
How often do people ask you if we're going to go back to the moon?
Never. What they do ask, when are we going to go to Mars? Which is that's the right question, I think.
Right.
When are we going to go back to the moon might have an answer, but that's not pushing a frontier. And at the talks that I give, I'd like to think that people went there wanting to be brought to the frontier, and by the time we're done, we're all sitting there with our toes curled over the precipice looking out into the abyss of the unknown, and that they draw their questions from that border between the area of knowledge we have and the volume of ignorance that lay before us.
Well, let me remind you of one person who might have asked about the moon, if you can remember as far back as the last presidential primary cycle. This is Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich.
We will have the first permanent base on the moon, and it will be American. We will have commercial near-Earth activities that include science, tourism, and manufacturing, and are designed to create a robust industry precisely on the model of the development of the airlines in the 1930s.
Rather than go into the feasibility of what he's discussing, I mean, you have to admire his bravado, right?
Of course. And that's, just to be clear, that speech was given, if it's the one I think it is, that was given in Florida, which has very strong space interest, not only in industry, but also NASA's presence is very strong. So that was, he would not be giving that speech in Idaho, okay?
No.
Or places where people have no thinking, no active thoughts about our presence in space.
Granted. And yet this debate, especially in light of the recent commercial space flight, both the controversies and the victories there. The question over
The failures and the victories.
Yes.
We had an explosion. We had one of them exploded.
And another crashed. And caused the co-pilot's death. However, I mean, this question keeps coming up. What should be the mission of NASA as opposed to what should NASA leave to private interests?
So that's a question that actually comes up every now and then. I have a very strong view on that, most of which has landed in the latest book that I published a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. It's called Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And in there is where I lay out the argument that private enterprise, unlike what Newt Gingrich was supporting at the time, and I haven't spoken to him one-on-one about this to see if he's thinking about something that I missed in his argument, but as his argument is portrayed, it is not feasible. You cannot lead a space frontier with private enterprise because a space frontier is expensive, it's dangerous, it has unquantifiable risks if you're on the frontier. And so you can't be a private industry and say, okay, who's going to invest in my next project? And so I'll be it, but I have some questions. And how much will it cost? I don't know, but a lot. Is it dangerous? Yes, people will probably die. And what is my return on investment? We don't know, probably nothing. And initially, and I don't have invest. There's no capital market valuation of private industry to do something expensive such as that that no one has done before. So governments do that. And then once the patents are awarded, and when you see where the trade winds are, and where the hostiles are, and the friendlies are, and the maps are drawn, then private enterprise comes in after to make a buck on that and to do it more efficiently than the people who did it first could have ever imagined doing it. That's how that unfolds. And that's the history of any time that has unfolded. The first Europeans in the New World was not the Dutch East India Trading Company. It was Columbus, funded by Spain. Then commercial enterprise follows. So when you want to think about the role of commercial craft in space, and people say, well, what's the future for NASA if SpaceX is doing this? SpaceX is hauling cargo back and forth to the space station. That's not a frontier. That's the routine things that the government should never have been in, ever. And I think private enterprise should have been engaged 20, 30 years ago doing just what they're doing now. So we're delayed in this. But if you just follow the history of this kind of exercise, yes, the government does the expensive things first, figures out that you can make a buck. Private enterprise comes in. They make the buck. We push the envelope even further.
Well, then what is probably our next frontier is Mars, as you mentioned. So let me ask you the question you get all the time. When do you think we'll get there?
So I think, this is my opinion now, I don't think NASA should be destination-driven because that comes with risks that are not solvable once you arrive at your destination. We were all about the moon in the 1960s, and then we got to the moon. It's like, okay, anybody ready to go anywhere else? Well, we don't have funding. We don't have spacecraft. We don't have planning. We don't have the engineering because that wasn't what we were doing for the past 10 years. And so I analogize this to the interstate system in the United States, where you don't build a road from New York to Los Angeles and say, there you go, that's the only point of this road. No, you build roads everywhere and let people figure out how they want to use them and where they want to pitch tent and where they want to set up industry. And so the roads then become the web of what connects people's creative interests that you don't pre-decide what they would be. So in the United States, So in space, what I would say the best way to approach this is you develop a whole suite of launch vehicles, one that can go to the moon, one that can go to Mars, one that can go to an asteroid, one that can go to a comet, one that can go to the outer solar system, and there could be scientific needs, touristic needs, mining desires for asteroids rich in minerals. There could be military needs. There could be needs unforeseen. But we would be turning space into our backyard the way the interstate system turned the country into our backyard on Earth. Our backyard in space is access to any place we want to go for whatever reasons a creative, free country decides. And out of that would come innovations and patents and the frontier of all the major STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and math. All the fields in the STEM portfolio would be represented in the innovations to achieve this goal. Or, you know, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, aerospace engineering, biology, we might be looking for life on Mars, chemistry, we might be trying to grow something in the soils, or botany, biology, all of this. That's the future that I think should await us here in America and for our species. To the extent that it's not, we will fade to insignificance on the world stage.
Well, this is why people flock to hear you speak and why I don't believe there's only 2 good minutes out of every speech. I don't believe
Thank you for
it for
that
a second.
Time.
That was famed astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson chatting with Celeste Headlee. We're listening back to some of our favorite segments hosted by Celeste on this program. She stepped down as host of On Second Thought last week. Coming up next, her conversation with Pulitzer Prize winning author Alice Walker. It's On Second Thought.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some...
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. All this week, we have aired some of the best interviews by Celeste Headlee, who stepped down as host of On Second Thought last week. Tomorrow, we will end the week with the woman herself. I will be speaking with Celeste on her own show about her time here at GPB. What would you like to know about her career or On Second Thought behind the scenes? Give us a call at 404-500-9457. You can post to Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. And be sure to tune in at 9 a.m. tomorrow for that interview. Alice Walker is home. Her rural Georgia upbringing in Eatonton has had a heavy influence on her writing. She became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. That was in 1983 for her novel, The Color Purple. She spoke with Celeste Headlee in 2015.
It is a real honor to welcome you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
I think that many people who love your work, and I have to imagine that's the way, as an artist and a writer, that's the way most people, general people, know you, although you're incredibly active and have always been in activism. I think people sometimes forget your history as part of the civil rights movement, which goes back to your days as a student at Spelman. Can you explain to me what that path was like? And what I mean by that is, at the same time that you're learning how to become a novelist and a writer, you're also focusing a great deal of attention on activism. You're taking time off to lead voter registration drives. Were those two separate paths, the art and the activism?
Well, no, you have to understand that if you're going to be an artist, you need to, for instance, be able to make a living. And if you can't make a living except doing, you know, chores that were specifically designed for just black people, then that is not, you know, that's not a good thing. So you have to go against the culture that is actually forcing you to do things that are likely to make it impossible for you to be an artist. So, for instance, one of the things that still prevailed when I was growing up was that I couldn't try on a dress in a store, you know, on the main street. And that could really upset your whole life, not to mention the day, you know, that your mother brought you into the store.
So let me take you back then, since you mentioned growing up. I read one place where you said you had to hide your writing from your family. You started writing when you were about 8 years old?
Sometime early, yeah.
Why did you keep that secret?
Well, when you grow up in a family of, you know, lots of people.
Yeah, you were the youngest of eight, right?
7 brothers and sisters. And a very, very, very small house and very little paper. So it was better to keep things from my 2 brothers. Who were very likely to, you know, want to intrude and read and laugh and whatever. So I learned to write in my head much more than on paper for many, many, many years. And in fact, I almost never did drafts until quite late in my writing life. I preferred to compose things almost entirely in my head and then write once and that would probably be it. But it would take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Do you think that has, in the end, affected your writing style?
I don't know. I mean, I would imagine everything you do affects, what you produce.
Yeah.
But it helped me because it saved a lot of trees. And I was glad of that because I always loved trees. And I just liked the reality that people, human beings, are so beautifully made that we can hold an awful lot in the mind and work on things in the mind, and there's a freedom to that, so that often you can just avoid a lot of things that are going on around you because you have a world that is full in your own imagination.
I wanted to ask you about Zora Neale Hurston, who seems to have been a constant influence for you. And I mean, people said that you almost single-handedly rescued her from obscurity. You went and actually found her gravesite back in the 70s. You've had a link with her most of your life. What draws you to her?
Because I didn't have a link. She died when I was a junior in high school. And I had no clue that she'd even existed when I went away to college at Sarah Lawrence in New York. My teacher had known her, but never mentioned her. And her name was in the first book I was published in, but because, at that time we thought only the men were writers, I never even noticed. And so years later, when I discovered that she had existed, that she'd written Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I adored it, I couldn't believe how she had been so, forgotten by people who had known her and so ignored. And then to discover that she'd also been vilified and very badly treated. So, yes, I loved her so much, and I went to Florida, and I found the only sunken place in this huge field that could have been her grave, and that was, a wonderful thing for me. I felt, that was something that she really deserved, and now people, people love her, and they go there by the thousands every year.
I wonder, Zora Neale Hurston could have been a cautionary tale if you had seen her that way, in terms of being careful about the way that your activism and your political voice may influence the way people see you and treat you. And I wonder if you ever thought about that. You've been so active all your life, and you have never shied away from putting that into your novels and your poems and all of the other writing that you do. Did it ever concern you that it might affect the way that you were treated, or whether you were published, or the way you were reviewed?
Oh, well, yes, and it has of course affected everything my whole life. But what you learn is that it is such a joy to be able to speak what you see and to share what you know, that it's worth the consequences. So I've always felt that. And I think she did too. I mean, in her case, it was to show the beauty of African-American Southern culture. And she was going to do that whether people liked it or didn't like it or whatever they had to say about her. She paid the price, and I think you just have to be willing to accept that whatever other people do is their business. Your business is what the mission that you're on, and it's not something that's negotiable, really. I mean, it's just who you are and what you are put here to do.
So, in your book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, since we're talking about joy here, this is a book that's it's difficult to read, and I don't mean the writing itself is difficult. It's that you are talking about the issue, the practice of female genital mutilation in parts of Africa and the Middle East and other places, and you do not shy away at all from graphic depictions. It's a beautiful book. But it's hard for me to imagine how you came at the beauty and the language with such a topic. And I wonder if you said you don't write drafts, but do you go back and on a book like that to make sure of where that line is?
Oh, yeah. No. By then, I was doing drafts. I was just explaining that in the beginning, you know, I didn't do many drafts because I had learned to be very careful of you know, people intruding, and also we didn't have a lot of money to spend on paper. But no, of course, as I went along, I could afford paper, and I could afford drafts, and I could throw things in the waste paper basket. But yeah, with that particular book, it's just that I love little girls. You know, I love children, and I couldn't imagine. I learned about this when I was in Kenya, when I was, I don't know, in my 20s, I guess. And it was so shocking that I just hid it from myself for decades. I couldn't imagine what I could do or if anybody could do this, because we're talking about millions of children. And so I worried it and worried it for a long time. And then I realized that it was obviously something that I had been trained to do, to write about this. My background was so poor and so hard, and yet somehow my parents and my community had sent me off, and I had become educated and I could write. And then the universe had said, "Well, here, look at this." And so it was clear to me that I was there. I had the tools, and I should do this work. And I did it, and I'm very glad. I know a lot of people have been very unhappy. And, I've heard from a couple of the surgeons who do this in hospitals in the West, for instance, in London and New York and, other places, which, is shocking enough.
Yeah.
But they, they have thought that instead of doing it in an unhygiene way, we should do it, hygienically in our hospital. As if that helps the child later on who has to grow into an adult who has to deal with the consequences of being mutilated in this way.
A lot of scholars say that novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, is part of a trilogy with The Temple of My Familiar and The Color Purple. And I wonder if that's how you intend... I mean, scholars are writing about them that way, but I wonder if that's how you intended them.
No, I don't believe in sequels, and I don't believe in trilogies. For myself, other people can have them, but no. I mean, it the characters sometimes are. Tashi is on one page.
Tashi's the African wife of Seeley's son from the novel Possessing the Secret of
Joy.
Right. Yeah.
But this is her story, and it's not really. But on the other hand, if people want to read it that way, I really don't mind. I mean, read it however you'd like. But I don't, I remember when we made the movie of The Color Purple and they were wondering and wanting a sequel, and I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't want any spinoffs. I don't want, to wake up one day and have, some crazy, idiotic sentences coming out of anybody else's mouth, Seeley's or Suge's or Sophia's or Mister's. It would be horrendous. Because each work comes as a whole, complete thing itself, and you don't have any plots and plans, I mean, at least I don't, for trying to spin it off into something else. I have to be really drawn to each individual subject and each situation, and then I give it my full attention for a couple of years.
Now, you've described yourself as a womanist as opposed to a feminist. What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, I'm an African American. My adventure, and actually it has been an adventure, but my reality here in the United States is very different from that of a white person or a white woman. So, there is feminism, which is a valid thing, and I am fine to be a feminist, but womanism means that I incorporate and that I stand firmly in my tradition as an African-American woman and what that has meant.
Is that a response? There has been a lot of complaints from women of color that the feminist movement, the new feminist movement, is a largely white female movement and is sometimes
insensitive and sometimes openly aggressive to the struggles of women of color. Is that part of what you're responding to?
Well, I think the truth is really that what we're seeing is something that has been going on all the time. Is that generally speaking, I think many white feminists have seen the struggle to be equal with the white man, and that is to basically, be a bit above everybody else as a couple. And this is the history, that is just the reality. And I think many women of color and other, women in the world have assumed that feminism meant that your loyalty would be to all the women of the planet. It wouldn't be to, marry the top guy and then rule over everybody else. But what seems to be, somewhat unsettling is the notion that the white woman who comes to consciousness about her own, inequality because she's female is actually wanting just to be equal with the man who's on top, i.e. the white man, and therefore not loyal to the other women of the planet. And in fact, often is detrimental to them. For instance, in the government, where often white women who come to power don't seem to be all that conscious that the countries that they talk about bombing are full of women. They are full of women and children. So what kind of feminism is that? To be consciously aware of women and children would mean that you would not say, as Hillary did at some point, we will obliterate Iran. You can't talk about obliterating, a country and all the people and still say you are a feminist. I mean, what are you talking about?
That was award-winning author Alice Walker talking with Celeste Headlee. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. Celeste Headlee stepped down as host of On Second Thought, and we are re-airing some of our favorite segments with her. What was your favorite Celeste moment? And what would you want me to ask her tomorrow? Going to invite her as a guest right here on her own show. Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can post to Twitter or Facebook. We are at OST Talk on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.